You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Do you consider yourself a nerd? Maybe you're a big superhero comic fan, or you love to geek out to Harry Potter fan fiction. Our next guest loves a wide variety of what we could call nerd culture, and she says it deserves the same level of cultural analysis and criticism that we usually think about for things that are, you know, more highbrow, a fancy art house film or prestige television. She shares that love in a new book, along with a look at how nerd culture takes on things like race, sexuality, and mental health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you nerd out about? What are those movies, books, TV shows, comics, you name it, mean to you or add to your life? Do you feel like you're part of a community, a fandom for some particular pop culture? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maya Phillips is a poet, author, and critic at large for the New York Times. Her new book is Nerd, Adventures in Fandom, From This Universe to the Multiverse. She's appearing at the Wisconsin Book Festival tomorrow at 9 p.m. at the Madison Public Library Central Branch. Maya, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Can you share your origin story a little bit? Where did you first start to love nerd culture?
Oh my gosh. It has always been a part of my life. I don't even know. I mean, even from when I was a child, from a very young child, I remember I was just watching like early anime. Like I remember I watched Speed Racer when I was still in diapers. Like I was watching early anime from elementary school. I was watching Dragon Ball Z and Pokemon, and I was into Harry Potter when it came. You know, it has always been a part of my identity. And It's interesting to see how it's become so mainstream now.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, but I want to get into this idea. I think this is really central to a lot of your essays here. We think sometimes, okay, yeah, the serious criticism we're going to do for the fancy stuff, this is like escapist entertainment. We don't really need to engage with it that carefully. Why is it important to you that we do that?
It's important because these fandoms reflect who we are, what we believe culturally, what we believe individually. And it, you know, like people, there's a reason why people get up in arms about the representation in their fandoms, or like how things are portrayed, the politics of it. If you look at these fandoms, you can see a swath of what we believe as a culture and what we value. And I think that's really important.
I think sometimes a reaction to this kind of look is, just given the way the internet works now, is I love this thing, and if you're engaging with it and you say something bad about it, you know, we're on opposite sides. There's this like us versus them sort of thing. You clearly, in a lot of the pop culture you write about it, you might see concerns and problems. We'll talk about that. And yet you still love the thing. How can we separate out that, you know, yes or no, us against them mentality?
You know, I wish there were a better solution than, guys, you just need to chill out a little bit. Because I do get it a lot. Whenever I write an article on a beloved fandom, something that I even love, like Avatar, The Last Airbender, I wrote about that and people were upset because I was analyzing it. And I think there just needs to be a better understanding that the reason why I'm analyzing it, the reason why I'm taking the time to think through these thoughts and to, you know, go through each episode or like sit through the movies once, twice, however many times, is because I do care about this. And I do care about how this art can be improved.
We're talking to Maya Phillips. Her new book is called Nerd, Adventures in Fandom, From This Universe to the Multiverse. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself to be a nerd? If so, what for? Is there one particular thing you're really into? Are you a dabbler like me, or really into a lot of different things like Maya? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You write about not just the, you know, the books and comic books themselves, but also you have an essay about fandom and how as things have gotten more mainstream, we've, I don't know, started to connect with each other and build identities in some ways around our love of nerd culture. How do we get there?
You know, it's really interesting. That's the fun thing to really see about fan culture. You know, I think it's something that we saw really early on with people who are Star Trek fans. Like, they had that kind of really big community that was really active. And, you know, now we see it a lot more. I talk about people identifying with different houses in Harry Potter or different villages in Naruto. There's so many ways to relate to a fandom and like take that into real life in places where you might not feel as included as, you know, a person of color, a person with disabilities, a person, you know, of who's non-binary. That's why these fandoms are important. And, you know, it's great to see that in convention culture too, and how that's changed and how people react to gender bending, you know, doing different types of cosplay for different characters. That's really great.
You write about the treatment of race in a lot of different elements of pop culture. And there's an interesting, I think, question for people. Do we, in our science fiction or fantasy setting, do we try to, or superhero comic, do we try to talk about real world issues of race? That's one way to go. Or do we try to create a society that is outside of that, a utopia, at least when it comes to race, where we can get away from the bad stuff we have in our society? It's a tough question to answer, I think. What are your thoughts on that?
I think Black Panther is a really good example of that, that kind of addresses both sides of it. Because, you know, when we get to Black Panther, it's a very, Wakanda is very insulated, you know? They have been able to advance, they have all the technology, but they're hidden from the world. And they have this front that they're a third world country. But I think that it was really clever how the plot was created, that we have Killmonger come up as a person, as a Black American who was raised in the hood, and him coming to Wakanda and being like, you know, you guys have all these resources and you're not using it to help the other Black people across the world. So I think like that is a really good stand-in for a kind of ideological clash of what do we, especially when it comes to race and especially when it comes to like fantasy and sci-fi, all kind of genre works, like, are we actually representing an escapist fantasy where these people of color can just live freely, or do we engage with the real world, which is a part of our everyday experience?
One of my favorite elements of that you write about is time travel. When our characters go a time traveling, if our characters are white, we don't necessarily have to think about a lot. But you found some examples where Black people from the modern day went into, I don't know, Victorian England and places like that. How do you see that being handled?
You know, it's really disappointing to me because I watch time travel shows a lot. And one of my favorites is Doctor Who. And I see these characters and it's so easy to have the characters be white for that reason. Most of these characters in the time travel stories are white, or there's some kind of workaround so that they don't have to address race. But, you know, it's part of the Black experience. And if you are going to time travel, and if you're going to time travel in America, in Africa, in any of like the colonized parts of the world, that's going to be enslavement and the various indignities done to our race. That has to be part of the story. That has to be part of that character's arc. And to do that in a way that is respectful, but also makes sense to the story, it can be really difficult.
We're talking to Maya Phillips, critic at large for the New York Times, with us today to talk about her new book, Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you define nerd culture? Do you consider yourself a nerd about lots of things in general or something in particular? What do the things you nerd out on mean to you? Are you part of a fan community for something? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Maya Phillips from the New York Times about her new book, Nerd: Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite thing to nerd out on, call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Linda is with us in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hello. What? I'm wondering why we have to label people all the time.
As in nerd, for example, Linda?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Thanks for bringing that up, Maya. I mean, once upon a time, nerd was a negative thing that somebody called somebody who didn't want to be called that. This is one of those terms I think that's really been reclaimed. Could you talk about the label of nerd?
Sure. You know, and thanks, Linda, for your question. Yeah. I don't think labels are super important. And I think that's part of what I'm kind of poking fun at with my title. That, yes, nerd used to be something you would call someone who was involved in something a little bit niche, and it was a derogatory term. And now people will say, yes, I'm kind of nerdy, or like, I love to nerd out about this. And so we see how those kinds of labels can change and how people can embrace them depending on what is happening in the zeitgeist. And I think that what's important is not the label, but just the meaning behind it. And for me, being a nerd is something I just say to let people know that I am passionate about these fandoms, and I am proud to say that I'm passionate about them.
Linda, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Maya, that reminds me of your comment earlier about a lot of the things we're talking about here getting more mainstream. You talk in the book about being able to show up at a major comic book convention without a lot of advanced planning and getting tickets, not something that could not happen today. Why do you think these elements of nerd culture became so mainstream?
I mean, it's funny because we were able to see that with Hollywood. I mean, Hollywood did pretty much all of that work. You know, you can see the shift starting with the Spider-Man movies, you know, the Sam Raimi movies. And then, of course, once the MCU got started with Iron Man, once Hollywood found out that there is an audience for this stuff and they can make these big hit action blockbusters, that they invested the money into expanding that into, and now we have all these television shows, we have all these different types of adaptations, we have, you go across every streaming service, you will find something that, you know, just a decade or two ago would have been considered a little too niche. So now it seems like people can come out into the open and say, yes, I'm very into this. And it can also invite new fans in who may not have encountered this before.
Let's go back to our callers. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Liz?
I remember her referencing Doctor Who, and I have two questions. Bringing on someone of a different race and gender, what do you feel like the repercussions would be? Do you think people would be very upset about it? Me currently, I did not like the current one and the previous male. I liked everybody before that, even going all the way back. And so I'm wondering, how can I break through to that as well?
Interesting, Liz. So this is the character, the Doctor in Doctor Who, an alien who changes form to be able to change actors over time, for those not familiar with the show. And there's a woman doctor still, I believe, the concepts of changing race or gender for that character.
Yeah, I think it's really, I was really excited when Jodie Whittaker was named the next Doctor. I think she is a brilliant actress, but I think that the writing changed in such an unfortunate way that there was an increased consciousness of addressing her as a woman and addressing, you know, race in new ways, because she has, or at least in the beginning, she had these multiple companions of color. And it just moved too far in the opposite direction, where it felt like wokeness for the sake of being woke. And it felt like being educational as opposed to actually, you know, thinking about the story and thinking about creating an entertaining and experience that kind of, you know, had the same kind of imagination as the previous doctors. And a lot of people blamed it and say on the doctor herself, unfortunately, saying that this is why we can't have a female doctor, but it's not that. It comes down to the writing and being more conscious of, you know, writing these stories for women or people of color. You know, the next doctor was announced and he's going to be a Black doctor. And I'm really curious to see how those writers go back and address his race and are aware of it without making it a whole big deal. Because we don't want another token character. We don't want to have stories that feel tokenizing to the doctor.
Liz, thanks a lot for that call. Peter joins us now in Green Bay. Peter, hello.
Why, hello. Thank you for the presentation. I'm an unapologetic fan of many fandoms. I had a quick linguistic question. It may seem pedantic, but is there a difference between a geek and a nerd? Does that even matter anymore?
Peter, thanks for the call. Geek, nerd, I think that's been an argument argued many times, Maya.
Oh, yes, it has. I actually was thinking about that a lot when I was writing this book. You know, I think I don't think it matters too much. I think personally, for me, I consider a nerd a person who is into some kind of fandom like I talk about, like comic books, like sci-fi, like fantasy, you know, genre, niche genre. And I consider a geek a person who is into technology, you know, like and a kind of IT person or someone who might be kind of into gaming a lot or into computers. But that is my personal definition. I really think people use it interchangeably. People have their own personal preferences, but I don't think it's really based in anything anymore. I think just you call yourself what you call yourself. Like we said earlier, the label doesn't really matter. It just matters what your interest is.
Thanks for the call, Peter. We're talking to Maya Phillips about her new book, Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. Back to your calls now with Tom on the line in Marshfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you guys today? I came to the Big Bang Theory about during season 3. I'd heard about it, but I'd never watched it before. And the minute I watched it, I was hooked forever. And I like the fact that they used science and humor and also had real scientists come on the show occasionally. And I was wondering what she thought about that.
Tom, thanks for the call. One of the highest profile TV depictions of nerdery, Maya.
Yes, I also was into the Big Bang Theory for quite a while. My mom still watches it when it's on reruns. And I did really enjoy it, that the references wove it into the conversations. They were pretty seamless. And my problem with the Big Bang Theory became, once I became more aware of it and once I was starting to watch it for a while, was the depiction of the male fans and the kind of misogyny that is baked into the show. And I think that is a problem in fan culture, of course. There's a lot of misogyny in fan culture. A lot of times it won't be very inclusive of women. And I think that unfortunately, as opposed to the show reflecting that, the show also had that in its DNA. And I don't think that was fully intentional with the show. So I will still watch reruns occasionally, but I do find it kind of cringeworthy, unfortunately, sometimes, just the way that they talk about their relationships and their women. Like, these are kind of toxic guys. But as I said, I already see that enough at conventions.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Chelsea is with us in Madison. Chelsea, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say I've always loved reading science fiction and fantasy, and I'm very happy that in the last couple of years we've been able to have more critical conversations about how women and people of color are depicted in these stories. But I've definitely avoided rereading some of my favorites for fear that I won't enjoy them as much anymore. How do you be critical of these stories while still enjoying them?
Interesting question. Yeah.
You know, it's really tough. It can be really tough. I think that You know, I think that you do kind of have to put your critical side to the side. If you can, like, if you really want to enjoy these things that cause, you know, that give you the sense of nostalgia that you enjoyed as a kid that you know are problematic, I think you can have a moment where you say, okay, I know this is not great for this reason, but you can still move on and like go, you can reread it or you can rewatch it. And I think as long as you have that awareness, then that's fine. Like, these are all personal interests. These are all personal loves. And so no one will judge you sitting in your house watching something that you loved when you were a kid. No one's going to do that. I think it becomes a problem when we give more money to things that are problematic, when we engage in a public forum with things that are problematic without actually signaling that, you know, this is the problem with this, this is the problem with that. So as I said, enjoy what you're going to enjoy. And, you know, just keep it in mind that some of these things don't age well. And that's just the nature of everything. Even things today that are really popular, we'll find something that's wrong with them in the future. That's how it goes.
Thanks for that call, Chelsea. And Maya, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Maya Phillips from the New York Times talking about her new book, Nerd: Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. If you want to listen back to this full conversation or hear any of the discussions we've had on Central Time, you can find them all on our online archives. Those are at WPR.org, along with a lot more. Articles from WPR's news department, podcasts, and live streams of WPR's two networks. And we're always happy to hear from you. If there's an issue you think needs more attention on the air, or if there are people working on it in your part of Wisconsin, we want to know about it. You can email us at centraltime@wpr.org. Regular listeners may have noticed that I was off for a few days there, thanks to Lee Rayburn for filling in. I was on a fun little trip to New Orleans, and I learned something. I always thought Mardi Gras was just like that one day, but no, it's Mardi Gras season from January 6th to Fat Tuesday. So I got to see a couple of parades, one smaller one I just ran into. The theme was a bunch of guys wearing beads and hats, as far as I could tell. But then there was a big one that I made a point of seeing called Chewbacca's, with lots of crews based on Star Wars and other science fiction. It all made me think we could do the same thing here in Wisconsin. We like to celebrate. Parades and costumes are fun. Just one hurdle. When I saw those parades at night in New Orleans, it was like 60-some degrees there. I looked at the temperatures back home here in Wisconsin. Low single digits and some negatives, too. So maybe there is a reason it all happens in New Orleans, but not here. Letting the good times and low temperatures roll, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, learn about Welcome Corps, a program the White House rolled out last month that lets private citizens sponsor refugees to resettle in their communities. Now, the Food and Drug Administration is proposing new limits to the amount of lead in baby food. A draft proposal sets limits at 10 parts per billion in fruit, meat, and most vegetable products, 20 parts per billion for cereal and root vegetable products. The FDA points toward the particular vulnerability of babies and infants to the effects of lead exposure. Dr. Dennis Kostakis is the department chair of pediatrics and a neonatologist at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. He's also an assistant professor of pediatrics at Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. Dr. Kostakis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me for this important, what I think is an important topic.
And could you talk about why this is so important, lead exposure, especially for babies and infants?
Well, first of all, when you think about lead, you know, with the smelting of silver, you know, 4,000 years ago, one of the byproducts was lead. For a considerable amount of time, even in this century, you know, we had lead-based paints, which you can still find sometimes in older homes. We had lead in gasoline, which, you know, sort of disappears in the 80s and 90s in the U.S., and the good news is blood levels in general for lead, which we never believe has a safe level, have been falling in the United States. I mean, we watch the levels, they are decreasing. And they've also been decreasing in places like France. So human beings have gotten smart to say, you know, we don't really need lead in gasoline. We don't really need lead paint. So how do you get lead in your body? Well, you eat it, or you breathe it, or you put it on your skin. Most of the absorption is going to be inhale it or eat it. Now, you mentioned, why are children more vulnerable to lead? Children tend to, if I were to eat some lead, I might absorb 1 or 2% of it, but a child will absorb about 50% of that. So if you think about children, where do they begin? They begin in utero as a fetus. And of course, lead exposure there is going to be through the mother. So I think prenatal care is important, because one of the ways to mitigate lead is to have a good iron status. So in prenatal care, you know, hemoglobin, hematocrit is checked. Prenatal vitamins, very typically with iron, is given. That helps mitigate any lead. And lead will be passed through the placenta. Once a baby's born, you know, you might ask, well, what is the most normal healthy diet for a baby? Well, the answer is breast milk. And, you know, if you ask yourself, well, how would lead get in the breast milk? Well, if all of us living in the world get some lead in our water, which we do, and you can measure lead to parts per trillion. And certainly with water, just like they want to do with baby food, with water, we like to keep that water, parts per billion on the 15 level, if you will. But people who are breastfeeding, they eat, they drink water. So society also got smarter a ways back of saying, well, let's not use lead solder when we do piping. So that's also tremendously helped. And so if you're a breastfeeding woman, maybe you wouldn't want to be around a house that's being renovated, you know, especially if that house is prior to 1978, that would kick up some lead or lead dust. You always want to know what's being put in your body, because you see, the reason lead gets into things like baby food is some of the baby foods are made, whether they're cereals or whether they're from fruit, once it's in the soil, lead is in the soil, of course, it's going to get into the plants and the fruits. So maybe one key would be for women who are pregnant or even after the child is born, is having a diverse diet. You want to put things in your body that you know what they are. So for example, take marijuana, for example. Marijuana does have lead in it. So, you know, that's not going to be something the FDA is going to necessarily check out for you. So you want to be clever about that. I'll give you a funny story. One of our teapot sort of cracked a few weeks ago in my house. We'd had the teapot, a nice, very nice teapot that we bought many, many years ago, and it had to be tossed out. So looking around for another teapot in the house, there was one that looked almost antique. We were looking at it just for show. And I boiled some tea, and then I realized, wait a minute, I don't know anything about this teapot. Could this be a teapot that, has lead in the ceramic? Mm-hmm. So the other thing you want to be careful of is not only the food and what you're putting in your body, but when you think about it, if you are living in Wisconsin, your water's probably being monitored. You can get water tested. But that also means that if you're using ceramics or pottery, you know, where are they from? How old are they? Are they lead-based?
I want to key in, because we don't have a ton of time, Dr. Kostak, because I want to key in on the baby foods. Now we think of the jar of the strange sweet potatoes, or that box of the rice or wheat cereal. What do you make of these new FDA draft guidelines on those?
Oh, I would not be too overly alarmed as a parent. I'd be looking and saying to myself, they're looking out for me. But even the amounts of lead that we're talking about in baby food will not hurt the baby. It's just that lead I want you to think of it as a neurotoxin. There's never a safe level. So you want to, a society, which has been doing over the last 30, 40 years in the United States and France and other places, we keep doing things that diminishes the amount of lead in the soil. And we keep getting, there's five or six different ways to test for lead. And we've got systems now that can even detect lead to parts per trillion. So for example, with this latest FDA saying, okay, 20 for the cereals. And by the way, one of the ways a mother could decrease lead to her baby is not just get rice cereal, but get some cereals that have quinoa or other grains, make it a very diverse diet. But basically, if we'd have gone back 20 years and you said to me, how much lead are we tolerating in the diet and what are we looking at? It would have been 100 times more easily. So we are actually, this is a really a call, you know, a higher standard. So I would tell, you know, give your children, or if you're pregnant, get a variety of foods in. Read the food labels. Make sure you're not getting food sources always from the same place. Don't stick with rice cereal. You know, you can use cereals that are based on oat, barley, you know, quinoa, I mentioned, bulgur, multi-grain infant cereals. Maybe that's the take home. That's what you should be giving your baby to mitigate this. If you're concerned about your water, get it tested. If you breastfeed the baby, you will reduce exposure to all the toxic metals, whether it's cadmium or lead. Baby food is one thing, snacks is another. You know, when children want to learn how to teeth, you're better off with a teething ring or even a little frozen banana. Crackers and teething biscuits, they're going to have more lead. And, you know, you know this and I know this, the less we eat processed foods, you know, the healthier. So, so I think that I would not be up for alarm. I would keep in mind that the babies, you know, 20, 30 years ago, were getting more lead. They're getting less now, but we can measure it better. And it looks like the FDA is putting a higher standard where they're going to watch the manufacturers. And I think that the amounts of lead we're talking about in baby food, you know, should not hurt the baby. But remember, lead, when it gets into a human, it can go into soft tissue, it can go into bone, it could go into blood and then come out in 30 days. But we also store some lead too. So, you know, we do want to decrease how much lead we're putting into our bodies.
Dr. Kostakis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Dennis Kostakis, Department Chair for Pediatrics and a neonatologist at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. He joined us for a look at FDA's draft guidelines on lead levels in baby food. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tribute to a Wisconsin astronaut who tragically passed away 20 years ago today in the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster.
So many people dream of going to outer space, of becoming an astronaut. Laurel Clark, she made that a reality. As writer Dean Robbins tells us, the Wisconsinite strived for greatness her entire life.
Astronaut Laurel Clark's life ended abruptly on February 1st, 2003, when the Space Shuttle Columbia exploded near the end of its mission. She was only 41, with a husband and an 8-year-old son. It's one of the saddest stories in NASA history, and yet, whenever I think about Clark, I don't focus on her tragedy. I focus on her smile.
3, 2, 1. We have booster ignition and liftoff of Space Shuttle Columbia with a...
You see it in photographs from the mission, as Clark poses with her 6 crewmates or floats through the cabin in her orange spacesuit. For someone who'd only recently envisioned herself in space, the Columbia experience was a dream come true.
Mission Specialist Laurel Clark, Payload Commander Mike Anderson, and Payload Specialist Ilan Ramon seated down on the middeck.
Back on Earth, Clark described herself as a boring straight-A student at Racine's-Horlick High School. She earned both a bachelor's degree in zoology and a medical degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she blossomed intellectually. After college, Clark's life was anything but boring. She joined the Navy, served as an undersea medical officer, and became a flight surgeon. After marrying fellow Navy officer Jonathan Clark, she threw herself into parachuting, rock climbing, and scuba diving. Always on the lookout for new challenges, she hatched the idea of becoming an astronaut in her 30s. The space program turned her down on the first try and accepted her on the second, while she was pregnant. Family and friends recognized Clark's toughness. They knew she would follow her own path, no matter the risk, and that she would enjoy herself in the process. Days before Columbia's liftoff, she had this to say on Milwaukee's WISN-TV.
This mission is just extremely exciting, and I still feel very fortunate to be assigned to this mission. I'm excited to be a test subject because I think that's how we get answers, is by studying people. And as a physician, I understand how important it is to collect data on people.
In space, Clark conducted experiments on moths and roses and played Running to the Light by one of her favorite bands, Runrig. Nearly 200 miles above the Earth, she also maintained her ties to Wisconsin. Two of her in-flight experiments originated at the UW. Her gear included a UW Medical School medallion and a teddy bear with UW-Madison and zoology embroidered on its jacket. For 15 days, 22 hours, and 20 minutes, Clark reveled in the wonders of spaceflight. In an email to the folks back home, she described her view from the porthole. Lightning spreading over the Pacific. The aurora australis lighting up the entire visible horizon with the city glow of Australia below. The crescent moon setting over the limb of the Earth. The vast plains of Africa and the dunes on Cape Horn. Clark was especially happy to get a glimpse of the Wind Point Peninsula jutting into Lake Michigan near her childhood home in Racine. Mere minutes before Columbia disintegrated due to a damaged wing, Clark was still in high spirits. The astronauts, unaware of the malfunction, joked around as she filmed them with a digital camera. After encouraging a crewmate to wave, Laurel Clark turned the camera on herself to provide one last image for posterity. It was a smile.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on Wisconsin astronaut Laurel Clark. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we learn about a new program that recruits U.S. citizens to sponsor refugees resettling here in the U.S. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The White House launched a new program last month that allows regular citizens to sponsor refugees from around the world. Welcome Corps is intended to make the refugee resettlement process easier and more welcoming. Anyone who can get together a group of at least five people and raise some money can participate. Anya McMurray is President and Chief Operating Officer of Welcome.us. Anya, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Big picture, what is the goal of getting regular U.S. folks together to help sponsor refugees?
Well, I think it's a couple of different things. One, it's to expand our capacity to welcome here in America. And we know it's one thing we're actually quite good at. And so by bringing everyday Americans into that process, we're opening up a system that creates more room for them to do just that. And also, we know that it will have better outcomes for the people who we are welcoming. We will be better able to get them settled, get them set up in their new communities, get their kids enrolled in school, and ultimately put them on solid ground to flourish in our new communities.
What's the first step if somebody's thinking, yeah, I've got some friends or community members or whatever, we could do this thing?
Yeah, well, it starts with a simple trip to a website, welcomecorps.org. There's a step-by-step process that you'll find some background information on what you can expect about this life-changing opportunity. And as you said at the beginning, it's finding a group of friends, maybe folks in your neighborhood or members of your church or synagogue, book club. Lots of different ways that you can do this. You have to raise a little bit of money, about $2,000 per newcomer that you support. And then there's an application process. And we've got systems in place to help you along the process every step of the way.
And the refugees themselves, can you talk a little bit about what they are going through and what kind of screening procedures they go through before they can participate in this?
Sure. These are folks who are a part of what's called the U.S. refugee admissions process. They have been thoroughly vetted. They've been identified by the United Nations, by UNHCR. They've been thoroughly vetted by UNHCR as well as several different component parts of the United States government. They have been deemed to be people in need of refuge, and they have had health clearings as well. So these folks are in the pipeline of individuals who've been determined to be safe, who have real need, and who Americans can provide an opportunity to start a new life here.
All right, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here now. We've got our group of five or more people. A refugee is coming. The sponsors have to have a welcome plan to get ready. What goes into that?
Sure. The welcome plan includes things like, where do you think this person will be able to find housing? Do you have a lead on an apartment? Maybe there's a landlord you know that would help reduce the rent. Where would their child go to school? How would you get them signed up for some of the benefits that they'll be eligible for? It's a step-by-step process that makes sure that you've wrapped your mind around the things that you'll need to do to make this a successful transition for this family. But it's also not overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It's really done in a way that breaks it down into bite-sized pieces. And I think that the thing that we try to remind folks is all we're asking is for you to be the tour guide to your community. Help them navigate systems that most of you know really well already. And to the extent you don't, there's a helping hand just around the corner to help you solve any problems you come up against.
Yeah, this I think that's a really big point. There is a serious commitment here, but it's not, make a bed in the spare room and this person's going to live with you for a year. There's a serious commitment, but it doesn't sound necessarily overwhelming.
That's right. It is. I think that's right. It's a serious commitment because you are offering really a pathway to a new life for someone. Those folks come with a lot of experiences. Many of them have been through some traumatic situations and are in need of a new opportunity. But what's great about this program is that it really provides a lot of the support systems that you'll need to make the most of it and to provide that really once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And one thing I'll say is what we hear over and over again from Americans who've been doing this is it changes their life every bit as much as it changes the newcomer they're welcoming. It's really a transformative experience.
Now, this Welcome Corps program itself is pretty new. What kind of response are you getting so far?
Well, the response has been overwhelming. It launched just a couple weeks ago, and we've had over 20,000 Americans sign up already who are eager to get started.
I know refugee admission numbers have gone down since the modern program started over the last 30 years. Are there enough refugees in need waiting and eligible for all these people to help them on board?
That's a great question. And the answer is yes. Unfortunately, one of the things that we know is true in this world is that people will always need a safe place to go. And America has such an amazing tradition of being that place for so many families for generations and generations. And what we are just tremendously excited about with this program is the opportunity to invite more Americans into that experience of helping refugees land on their feet.
Anya, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Anya McMurray, President and Chief Operating Officer of Welcome.us. She talked to us about Welcome Corps, the new program that allows regular citizens to sponsor refugee resettlement in their communities. You can find more information if you think you might be interested. Just look for that website, Welcome.us. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, many Americans don't feel engaged at their workplaces, according to a recent Gallup survey. We'll find out what might be driving that and what it means for our personal lives and for the jobs we do. If you feel particularly disengaged or particularly connected to your work, love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Plus, what are you made of? We'll get a super up-close answer with a look at the atoms and molecules in the human body and their origins, some of them in the stars. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, what's the best way to study for an exam or make sure we remember the things we learn? We'll find out what neuroscience tells us and get some advice for students and for the rest of us. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.